Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is David Yoshimura, who is the chef owner of Nisei in San Francisco, California. Nisei means the first generation, a son or daughter of Japanese immigrants who were born in the United States. Nisei is inevitably living dual cultures, and many of them choose to celebrate Japanese culture in different ways. And David is one of them. After working at the top restaurants in the world, he opened his own place named Nisei in 2022 and earned a Michelin star within 6 months after the opening. So today we'll discuss what it is like to be Nisei in America, how David expresses the Japanese tradition through his unique identity, how David explores possibilities of Japanese food in the global context by working with culturally diverse top chefs in the world, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. Please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with David Yoshimura. Hello, David. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Akiko. Thank you for having me.
So, this is exciting. I have a lot of questions. So to get to know you first, where are you from, and what did you eat when you grew up?
So originally I'm from Houston, Texas. I was born in America, and my father is from Japan. So my mother is American, so we kind of grew up eating a mixture of both American and Japanese food. So most of the time there was like a pot of rice always on the counter, so it was a lot of rice growing up, and usually like eggs or something to go with it.
Sounds traditional in Texas. So interesting. And so how did you get into cooking?
I'm an only child, and I grew up, both of my parents worked for the most part. And most of the time I would end up cooking for myself or my friends, and you know, sometimes I would say, you know, complain to my parents, like, oh, why can we have this, can we have that, and sometimes they would just say, oh, well, if you want it, you have to make it. So I kind of started out like that. And then my first job was as a dishwasher in a restaurant, like a local restaurant, and eventually that kind of grew into becoming a host, and then a prep cook, and then it grew into becoming a real cook, and then it kind of snowballed from there.
Right. So then kind of confirming that your love for food and cooking was real, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Right. And then you Before you opened Nisei, you worked at a very prominent restaurants that include Kagurazaka Ishikawa, Nihon Ryori Ryugin, and Asador Echabari in the culinary hotspot in Basque, Spain. So they're amazing. Like, Kagurazaka Ishikawa, Nihon Ryori Ryugin, these are really top restaurants in Japan as well. So, so what did you learn at these restaurants?
Oh, it's a kind of a broad question, but I mean, I learned a, yeah, I learned quite a lot. So when I went to Nihon Ryori Ryugin, I was very young. I was in my early 20s. So that's really when I made the commitment and the dive to kind of become a chef. So the first step I thought was, okay, well, I need to reconnect with my heritage and learn Japanese food from the best. So I sent them applications over and over again, and then I started sending them in Japanese, and they finally accepted. And I think when I learned from Ryugin was a couple of things, because Seiji-san is like, his style of Japanese food, first of all, it's incredible. I mean, he's kind of been at the top of his game for so long, and he has earned Michelin stars and such recognition because his food is incredible. But he started out kind of challenging Japanese food in a lot of ways. But then when I attended Ryugin, it was kind of going back more to almost traditional Japanese food, but just executed very well. So it kind of, what I learned at Ryugin was that it was okay to challenge tradition. And kind of, it's okay to challenge Japanese tradition. And that is something very important, because, you know, as a Japanese person and a chef, you know, tradition is very important to all of us. So, especially in cooking, you know, a lot of people don't want to deviate from the norm. And I think that working there taught me that it's okay to question, and it's okay to like challenge and do things differently. And then I think and the other two, I went to Asador Echabari at the recommendation of a friend. He said, okay, well, you know, if you want to learn other cuisines, you should try this one out. It's one of the best restaurants I learned there. And of course, if you're not familiar, it's a restaurant based completely around grilling. He takes it to the extreme, where he gets live firewood. He created the whole hearth movement in the culinary world. But he grills, everything has to touch the grill. Everything has to touch the flame. And so that was a really eye-opening, because it's one of the most delicious meals I've ever had in my entire life. But when you go into the back of the kitchen, it really is just very simple. It's just really just salt and grilling the product. And it's like, how is this so good? It really taught me that sometimes, like, on the opposite end of the spectrum, you know, sometimes uncomplicated food and just simple food is sometimes it's best. And then I guess to round it out, I'm sorry, this is too lengthy, but, at Kagurazaka Ishikawa, it's a very like massive restaurant group. And Ishikawa-san is like a force to be reckoned with. And he has so many restaurants. So when I was there, they actually had me kind of bounce around to some of their other restaurants when they needed help at like Kohaku, which is down the street. It's another 3-star. And Ren, which was in Ginza, they had me bounce around there as well. But working there, all of the entire group, it's almost kind of like, if you ever get to go, it's really incredible. It's almost like kind of like a cult. all the cooks like shave their head. And, you know, everyone has like a very high amount of teamwork and a very, like, very humble attitude, I guess, very, like, kind of Japanese in that way. But it really, like, you know, refortified, I guess, the Japanese kind of mentality in a kitchen, where it's, like, just stay humble and just, you know, you just want to get the perfect job done, but you have to do it through teamwork. And it was very nice to see and how much teamwork there was and how much, I guess, passion there was in each of the restaurants. And then their cuisine at Ishikawa is like, it's basically like kaiseki almost, but it's very simple, very, very, they do things like pretty traditionally, but they just do it very well and they use the best products. And again, it kind of went back to, okay, like, you know, sometimes simple Japanese food is sometimes best, but sometimes they would do other things too. They would like make some fun desserts or they would do things out of the ordinary. And it was kind of just like, it was the last step, the last like, I guess trip I had before I opened my own restaurant. So it kind of like strengthened my resolve to open up my own restaurant after that.
Right. Wow, amazing. So you kind of hit the triangle of business and as well as cooking. I have to know Chef Seiji Yamamoto of Ryugen, and he's not just super talented chef, but his management, how to deal with daily issues and kind of like a human management, it's just outrageously philosophical. And he inspires a lot of other people in the industry too. And it's really advancing. You know, chef's status tend to be much lower, but his mindset is elevating kind of culinary award status, which I really admire. I'm impressed at all those three places you worked. No wonder you got the Michelin star 6 months after you opened your own place. So that really makes sense now. Okay, so we'll talk about your restaurant, Nisei, in a moment, but let's take a look at the keyword, Nisei. So how do you define Nisei yourself, and what is it like to be Nisei in America?
So I would define Nisei as a second-generation Japanese person born outside of Japan, and that's what I am. So that's how I would define it, and what it's, I guess, what it's like, at least as a Nisei in America. I don't know about other countries. But for me, when I was growing up, I think that you're always kind of riding this middle ground of, am I American or am I Japanese? Or which one do I lean into? Like a lot of times when I was growing up, my father would kind of push me to do a lot of American things. And, you know, he pushed me to learn Spanish because it's more useful. I mean, I still learn Japanese as well, but he like really pushed me into doing a lot of American activities. It's like, okay, so should I be assimilating or should I be, you know, should I be more Japanese? So it was kind of always like this really strange middle line growing up. But luckily for me, I grew up in Houston, which is like more of like an urban setting, and there's lots of diversity in Houston. So I had a lot of Asian American friends growing up. So it kind of made me feel more welcome, you know, because a lot of them were going through the same thing. I had a lot of Chinese and Vietnamese friends growing up, and they all had the same kind of struggle where it's like, okay, well, I have this traditional side at home, but when I'm in school or with friends, we act American. So it's kind of like an awkward feeling, but I think that now that I'm older, I feel more comfortable with who I am, and as like, it's okay to be both, you know, it's okay to have both sides. And I don't have to say like, just say like, oh, I'm only Japanese or I'm only American. It's okay to be both.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. I was born and raised in Japan. I had no questioning. I'd even like, what is being someone not being Japanese? That's like, that's a question, but it's not a question because you can even think of what it's like to be. And we tend to, I think globally, we tend to think things are binary, right? Which one do you take? But that kind of flexible in-between area, I think is increasing the value. That's a uniqueness we can really enjoy. So, yeah, I think your definition is just fascinating. And that's very cool.
Yeah, I think also just to add on to that, I think, you know, not just for Nisei, but other Asian Americans and probably other cultures like Mexican Americans or whatever, you know, they probably feel the same kind of struggle, you know, where it's, I think they want to hold on to the traditions from their, you know, their parents, but at the same time, they want to be American. So it's like, I think it's a very common struggle, and that I think that it's, you know, that's why I created the restaurant, to just say like, oh, it's okay to be in the middle. You know?
Right. And also, you can keep changing too, right? Over time. So that's another you can design who you are, and you are representing how flexibly you can change your definition through your cuisine. And I think it's a very inspiring concept. You have this tool to express who you are, which is, I think, a very lucky thing.
Right.
Okay, so we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dive into David's restaurant, Nisei, and his inspiring collaborations with other chefs to explore global cultural heritage. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008, and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is David Yoshimura, who is the chef owner of Nisei in San Francisco, California, which earned a Michelin star 6 months after its opening. So let's talk about your very successful restaurant named Nisei, which you opened in 2022. So what is the concept of your restaurant, Nisei?
So Nisei is a contemporary Japanese restaurant that uses local California ingredients, and we represent it through a tasting menu.
Mm. So that allows you to express freely the flavors. And also, maybe going back to the Spanish cooking experience, you really maximize the flavor of rich California ingredients?
I think so. I mean, California, in my opinion, has some of the best produce in America. And, you know, if you're ever in the Bay Area, I think the Bay Area is the top of California ingredients. You know, we're very spoiled with having lots of farmers markets, and it gives us lots of access to local farmers. And on top of that, we're right next to the Pacific Ocean. So our seafood is very good.
Mm, right. And the essence of Japanese cuisine is, of course, the ingredients that's available seasonally and locally. So you really have the traditional mindset in California as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of my cuisine is based on the seasons, like most other Japanese restaurants. So I think that, again, like, we're pretty spoiled in San Francisco to have access to everything.
Mm. But by the way, why did you choose San Francisco? Because of that, the availability of the superb ingredients throughout the year?
It was partially that. Before Nisei, I was working at Californios, you know, trying to figure out if I wanted to stay in San Francisco and make this my home. Before California, I was based in New York. I worked at WE50 for some time. And I mean, I love New York, and it's an incredible city. And I think restaurants can thrive there. But as I worked longer and longer in San Francisco, I kind of came to realize that, this city is kind of in the middle of, it's like a culinary capital. You know, it was kind of on the rise for Michelin-starred restaurants when I first arrived. And I think, in my opinion, it still is. It's one of the best culinary cities in America, in my opinion.
Mm, right. I agree. For many other reasons, New York is very difficult. So I'm so glad, you know, I think the Michelin star restaurants are thriving throughout the country now. So I think definitely you are one of the leadership's restaurants. So that's
Thank
exciting.
You.
Yeah. So you offer multi-course tasting menus at Nisei. So could you pick some of your signature dishes and tell us the theme, maybe creativity and the traditional parts in each dish?
Sure. We were talking earlier that the food has kind of changed a little bit over since the opening. But I think some dishes that stand out that a lot of guests talk about is we opened up with like a Japanese curry with sweetbreads, chanterelle mushrooms, fermented Napa cabbage or hakusai, and cilantro flour on top. And I think this dish in particular is a little bit of a signature dish because it really does encompass kind of like a Nisei mentality. You know, everybody knows, and especially Americans, like, knows Japanese curry, you know, out of the box. I think a lot of us grew up eating it, and it's a comfort food. So I just wanted to recreate it. So what I did was I made the curry from scratch, which I learned how to make when I was at Ishikawa. And I added some squid ink to it to make it black. And so then I took sweetbreads, which I love sweetbreads. I grew up in Texas again, so I had a lot of Southern influence. So I deep fried some sweetbreads, put it in the curry, and then chanterelle mushrooms are from California, when they're very, very seasonal. And then the fermented Napa cabbage is just a very simple salt fermentation. It's like very traditional a fermented cabbage. There's nothing really secret about it. And yeah, I think it just really encompasses, you know, using local ingredients, but creating something similar or something, I guess, familiar for a lot of Japanese Americans, but kind of raising the bar a little bit.
Right. Well, the curry, I think Japanese curry is like a soul food of Japanese people. And I mean, people, if it came to Japan, when the British people came, that's what people say. But it's definitely Japanese, very Japanese food, even if it's called the curry. So I think your take on Japanese curry is very Japanese, but also, I mean, you can't go wrong, right? Squid ink and sweet bread. I am so hungry right now by thinking about it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So what else do you have?
I think another one that we were running for a long time was we were using a grilled American unagi. And we used to get our American unagi from Maine. This was more of a traditional dish. But it was using local ingredients. So again, it was American unagi, and then I just grilled it over the Bichotan grill, and I just grilled it the way that I was taught at Ryugen, you know, just very simple with tare. And then we used local sushi rice from Sacramento from a farm called Ruin Foreman. And we mixed the rice with furitake, which I make with all the fish scraps in-house. And then next to it, we usually have miso pickled garlic, which takes a couple months to make, and then just some daikon oroshi most of the time. So it's like kind of same thing, you know, it's like we're using all these local American ingredients, but I'm recreating it into making something Japanese, but it's still local. Mm. And then like, you know, it is like, there's a lot of, I think this dish is a little bit more traditional, but it's still very, it's riding that in between line of being American, but also Japanese.
Mm. Right. Well, I have to say you're challenging yourself because this unagi, that's the river eel, it's a challenge, right? It's like a test. It's like, how can you make the best burger? And it's just, you really have to be good at it. And the binchotan with the crispy skin of eel, it's a big test. And I think you're really raising the bar for yourself, but I'm sure it's amazing.
I think a lot of Japanese people from Japan are usually pretty skeptical when they come to eat at Nisei, because they're really, really, they're always kind of maybe putting me to the test, but almost always they're satisfied.
Right. Well, I think the binchotan is such a special charcoal grill, because the binchotan itself is very, very exceptionally well made. So the higher temperature, and also it doesn't smoke. So you really can enjoy the smell and taste of fatty eel. And it's just the beauty of Japanese culture. And I have to say, that's why their generations old Io restaurant in Japan. So yeah, so I hope I can get to taste that at your restaurant sometime next time I go to San Francisco.
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can keep talking about the dishes, but I want to ask you, you have a very interesting program called the, it's a dinner series at Nisei called the Third Culture, a Nisei collaboration series. So what is it and why did you start the series?
So the Third Culture collaboration series, it kind of started by, I wanted to kind of raise awareness for Asian and Asian American chefs. I think that there's a lot of Asian American chefs that are not getting a lot of as much press as they should be. And I think that my mission statement of Nisei being, you know, Asian and American, it's very powerful. And I think that a lot of other chefs reached out to me and they, you know, they would say the same thing. They would say, you know, like, it's so cool that you're like very proud of who you are as an Asian American. And so then I thought, you know, like, why not we all just get together and kind of celebrate it in a way. And so we came up with a series. And so every month we highlight one Asian or Asian American chef to kind of talk about, not only is it a collaboration event where we both kind of cook our own dishes, and then sometimes we make up some dishes together. And it's usually a 2-day event on Saturday and Sunday once a month. But not only do we make like delicious food, but there's also a discussion portion halfway through the meal. We do it twice. And we have a moderator who usually asks us like questions from the audience. At the beginning of the meal, we'll pass around some questionnaires and say, hey, if there's any questions you want to ask the chefs about their cuisine or their experience growing up as an Asian American, you know, we'll talk about it later. And a lot of the questions have been they've been great. I mean, they vary quite significantly, but we've seen a lot of good responses from the guests. And I think it kind of, not only does it make a great meal, but it also kind of makes you think about the experience of Asian Americans and how it reflects upon cuisine and culture in America.
Wow, that's an amazing idea. I wish other restaurants do not just this theme, but in many situation or, you know, who's cooking, who, what the themes are. This is amazing. So maybe you can share us what kind of interesting questions it was raised or anything, answer, discussions.
Sure. I mean, some of the questions that are asked are very similar to the questions that you ask Akiko. you know, they usually ask like, once a night we usually get, you know, what are some of the challenges of being an Asian American chef? And I think the way that usually I'll answer that is that I think for me, a challenge was almost like an identity crisis growing up, right? like I talked about before, it's like, okay, do I want to cook traditional Japanese food, or do I want to cook American food, or do I not even like, you know, what do I want to do? And then I think my answer to usually that question is, I just wanted to cook who I am. You know, I want to cook honestly for who I am, and I'm both. So I'm going to be cooking both California and Japanese. And like, for me, that was a big challenge, is like being okay with myself and, you know, cooking honestly with who I am. But I think another question that was kind of a fun one that we got last time was, we had one guest ask, you know, how did they say it? They said, you know, what is one ingredient or one dish that you would want to make in America that would be frowned upon? Which I thought was really funny. And so as a Japanese chef, you know, in Japan, you can eat all sorts of, you can eat whatever you want in Japan. Like, nobody really cares. And so it's like, you know, I was like, oh, well, I would love to work with horse meat maybe, or, you know, sometimes people eat whale in Japan. It would be fun to work with that. But I think in America, it's a little bit frowned upon. So I don't think we could do that.
Yeah, like live shrimp or something like that, right? It's more like a politically incorrect.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, interesting. So, but I think you just, in your answer, you know, the challenges being an Asian chef. But I think you're really representing what people cannot make, right? If you have just one national background, ethnic background, or how you define yourself, you can't make what you're making because you know both sides of the culture. You know how to merge them, and you can pick and choose whatever people you think is valuable, which is unthinkably valuable. So, yeah, I'm so glad this the series sounds like it's confirming what you're using is valuable beyond just the amazing Michelin stars. So, yeah. So, what kind of chefs did you have so far? What background and countries?
Sure. So the first, we only done maybe three or four now. The first one was James Perry. He's kind of just starting out in San Francisco. He's doing pop-ups under the name Happy Crane. And he's half Cantonese and half English. But he used to work at Ryugen as well. So that's how I kind of got to know him. And so he's like half Asian. So that was number one. Number two was a Korean-American chef. His name, he is the chef owner of Bar Maze. And his name is Ki Chung. He used to work in the Bay Area. And he currently works in Hawaii. And so his food is very kind of Hawaiian, Korean, but you can see the influence there. And then most recently, I did one with James Scheibout from Komi. So he's a two Michelin star chef in Oakland, so right nearby. And he's like Thai, Cambodian, or Laotian, I believe. But his food is at Komi is, you know, he has a ton of experience. Like, he's extremely talented and very humble. But his food, sometimes it can be Asian leaning and sometimes it's very California, and it was very, very humbling to work with him because he just makes it look so effortless and he's so comfortable with who he is. I was like, I was a little starstruck a little bit working with him. I was like, man, he's so much further ahead of me, but I kind of had a moment, but yeah, those are some of the chefs.
Mm, right. And also you have more people coming up, right? In June, July, August. So maybe you can tell us who is coming and when, because I guess listeners may want to participate in one of those.
Of course. Yeah. The upcoming one, we have a chef from Waikiki. Her name is Naogawa from Nature. She's actually first generation Japanese. And she uses a lot of local Hawaii ingredients, and she does have a vegetarian menu. So I'm interested to see like what she'll bring to the table. After that, in July, a former coworker of mine named Hieda Ryohei, he's from the old Taipei location of Ryugen. He was the chef de cuisine there. So he is extremely talented chef, and I actually used to stay on his floor when I was working at Ryugen. So I think he may have some not so fond memories of me and maybe some fond memories.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah, but he's a very nice guy. And so I'm excited for that one. And then in August, we have Chef Hirohisa from New York City, actually. He's going to come in. So a lot of things are lined up for the summer.
Awesome. Yeah, Hirohisa Hayashi from Hirohisa. He's got a Michelin star too, and he came to Japan Eats a long time ago. And he's a very super cool and funny person. So I'm sure you're going to have a great time with him. Mm. Right. So it's the next one is June 24th, 25th. That's from with Nae Ogawa from Honolulu. And July, I don't know the date, but end of July, I think the last week of July.
The end of July for Ryugen, and then the middle of August for Hirohisa.
Okay, so you can find this information on your website, right?
Correct, yeah.
Right. Awesome. So, and yeah, so I really think that what you're doing is not just running an amazing restaurant, cooking amazing food. So what excites you most about what you're doing? It's a broad question, but we have time.
Yeah. What excites me? Well, I think kind of what excites me these days is kind of like raising the bar on Japanese cuisine. I think, you know, for me, I think a lot of Japanese food, there's tons and tons of tradition you know, when I was working in Japan, you know, of course, you know, as well, it's like there's these shops and restaurants that have been around for centuries and their family, and they, you know, they are masters of whichever it could be, you know, like the unagi restaurant you're talking about. But for me, since I'm in America, you know, it kind of made more sense for me to be excited about, you know, raising the bar a little bit and doing something new. You know, I think it's fun to recreate dishes and kind of do things that people haven't done before in Japanese cuisine and use technique that I've learned in the past to kind of challenge people. You know, like I said, sometimes I'll have some diners that are very traditional Japanese people, and they'll kind of look down and say, you know, this isn't traditional Japanese food. And then, you know, to them, I just say, yeah, I know it's not. And that's okay. And it excites me. It's like, it's okay that it's not. So that's something exciting, I think, is recreating and making new dishes.
Right. Interesting. Mm. So I know that the Kyoto Kaiseki chefs wants to explore what they can do with the traditional ingredients as well. So it's kind of mutually, it's coming to more of exploration mindset. You know, rather than just get stuck in tradition, you have to. The world is connected, and everybody wants to use new ingredients, and that's a mutual, efforts to get more globally minded in Japan as well, and also someone like you, talented outside of Japan. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and it's funny that Kaiseki chefs. I stayed in Kyoto like 10 days. And I spent a lot of time with Kaiseki chefs, and they said, don't you get tired of the food because it's so seasonal, everybody's cooking the same thing. It's kind of true because every ingredient, this is a seasonal called the shun, so they're chasing each shun ingredients lasts only a couple of weeks, right? So just really fight for the best of that ingredient-specific ingredient, and then ended up doing the same thing at every restaurant. And if you just follow the same preparation, if you go to 10 Kaiseki restaurants, you tend to have the same kind of preparation. So that's what one of the Kaiseki chefs told me, which is funny because he's got a Michelin star and all those. That's the fact. Somebody has to explore something and find something new and then find something delicious and share it. And then that's how Japanese food has never got tired or aged. So I think you're part of that effort.
Thank you. But I completely agree. I mean, it's definitely the same mentality, whether you're a Kaiseki chef or, you know, something more, I guess, like American chef like me. I think something that I was thinking about when you were saying that is, you know, in California, we have lots and lots of seasons, very hyper-seasonal ingredients. Like we even get fresh bamboo here, which I don't think a lot of people know about. But one dish that we came up with recently is like, you know, we have beautiful morel mushrooms and all over California. So I stuffed it with tsukune and then I serve a soy cured egg yolk on the side. So you kind of dip it into the egg yolk, like almost like you have grilled tsukune. But instead you put it inside the mushroom. And I thought that was kind of fun. And same kind of thing. It's like have to find new ways to use these seasonal ingredients, and like that's what's keeping Japanese food alive.
Right. Wow. Yeah, sounds like California is the right place. I'm so glad you opened a place in San Francisco because it's a new discovery. I'm learning, especially in the world. And Chantal, you mentioned, why not, right? The shiitake I grew up with, it's kind of dominant. And you want to try some other flavors. Yeah, that's interesting. So, what are your plans and dreams? And do you think maybe you can write a book and share all those interesting recipes with the world?
It's funny that you bring up the book. Some people, it seems like the world keeps asking me if I can write a book. And I think it's too early for me to write a book. I think I'm still very, you know, I'm still a baby in the restaurant world, I think. But I think my plans and dreams, maybe eventually a book, but hopefully another restaurant or soon. I also, we have a bar next door called Bar Iris, and you know, we serve Japanese influenced cocktails and we serve like izakaya bites next door. But I think, you know, Bar Iris is so popular that it would be great to open almost like a second location somewhere, or maybe even like a second Nisei, because it seems like, you know, people are asking for more and more. It's like, okay, well, I have to give them the demand. I have to give it to them.
Right. So the concept of Bar Iris is more like a casual, and then you can just, instead of tasting menu, you can just go have nice cocktails and have some tsumami like snacks. Is that the idea?
Yeah, pretty much. The cocktails are very, very upscale, and they take a lot of time to make. So definitely going for more of a refined cocktail bar. But the food at the Bar Iris, you know, we kind of tend to do more, almost more like a izakaya style. Like we have a koroke and karaage on there, and we have some like temaki and, you know, things like that. We just put on like a cold somen dish, you know, just like really like easy and more relatable Japanese food.
Right. I like that you spend a lot of time making a cocktail. That's like a classic Japanese style bar. And you really wait, and then the time to wait for perfect cocktail, that really creates the time special to enjoy the drink as well. So that's cool. Right. So, well, this is because I've been talking about, you know, Japanese food in general from your, you know, broad perspective. What do you think about, you know, current Japanese food in America and the future? Because Japanese cuisine really dramatically changed since tempura sukiyaki and nobody ate sushi, and suddenly, you know, something like Nobu made Japanese sushi fancy, and then ramen came, and then we started to eat ramen and familiar with dashi and soy sauce and sake more. And now high-end Japanese sushi places came from Japan and they charge like really great, great quality sushi, but it costs a lot of money. And, you know, it's, to me, I'm not sure if it's the healthy development of Japanese food here. And like your place, as well as the Bar Iris in your own place, I think we have to make it more available and approachable and inspire people with new ingredients. And that's what I think, because I want to keep Japanese food as a part of American food and thrive and enjoy it widely because it's healthy and tasty. So what do you think about the future of Japanese cuisine here? Like what you want it to be like?
I think I'm very hopeful for the future of Japanese cuisine. I think that your history about it is very true. I agree with everything that you said. You know, I think that sushi, ramen, it's all very popular. And I think that America is accepting Japanese food extremely well. But I think for the future, I think at least in the Bay Area, we're starting to see a lot more different Japanese food that I think a lot of people aren't familiar with that are outside of sushi and ramen, which it's great. You know, like I think more people are learning more. Americans are learning more about the different aspects of Japanese cuisine. Like, you know, yakitori is starting to become more popular, and like some other, like, I guess, subsections of Japanese cuisine are all these different dishes that people are familiar with. So I think for the future, what I can see is, I think you'll start to see more casual shops of Japanese food. Like, you know, when you go to Japan, there's like most restaurants, they only specialize in like one thing, or they do something very well, like a tonkatsu place, or you can go and get like you said, an unagi restaurant. I think the future of Japanese restaurants in America will kind of hopefully follow that line. And, you know, maybe I can also kind of jump on that trend and lead it in some way, shape, or form. I would love to start seeing shops like that specialize in one thing. I think it's, for me, it's the ultimate business model. You know, you master one thing, and then of course people will want to buy it.
Right. Yeah. I'm now hopeful. So I keep watching you, and hopefully you can keep coming back here and discuss what's happening. So yeah. So where can we find your updates online and on social media?
Usually our Instagram is a good place to find updates. It's at @nisei_sf. Or you can just simply go to our website or our talk page. Talk is a reservation page, but mostly the Instagram is a good place.
Okay, so the website is Restaurant Nisei, one word, restaurantnisei.com. So, okay, so, well, congratulations again, and also good luck.
Oh, thank you so much. And I just want to say it was really an honor to be on your show. I've listened to it for quite some time, so thank you for having me.
Oh, that means the world to me, so thank you. So, all right, so... Listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatayama.com. Japan Needs is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. The engineer is William Werner, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week.
Japan Eats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.